Krishna 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 Rakshama
Rama Raghava Rama Raghava Rama Raghava Rakshamam Krishna Keshava Krishna Keshava Krishna Keshava Pahimam We're continuing with our perpetual reading of the Krishna book, and we're on page number 201. This is chapter 25, Devastating Rainfall in Vrindavan. When Indra understood that the sacrifice which was to be offered by the cowherd men in Vrindavan had been stopped by Krishna, he became angry. And he vented his anger upon the inhabitants of Vrindavan, who were headed by Nanda Maharaj, although Indra knew perfectly well that Krishna was personally protecting them. As the director of different kinds of clouds, Indra called for the Samvartaka. This cloud is invited when there is a need to devastate the whole cosmic manifestation. The Samvartaka was ordered by Indra to go over Vrindavan and inundate the whole area with an extensive flood. Demonically, Indra thought himself to be the all-powerful Supreme Personality. When demons become very powerful, they defy the Supreme Controller, the Personality of Godhead. Indra, though not a demon, was puffed up by his material position, and he wanted to challenge the Supreme Controller. He thought himself, at least for the time being, as powerful as Krishna. Indra said, "Just see the impotence of the inhabitants of Vrindavan. They are simply inhabitants of the forest, but being infatuated with their friend Krishna, who is nothing but an ordinary human being, they have dared to defy the demigods." Krishna has declared in the Bhagavad Gita that the worshippers of the demigods are not very intelligent. He has also declared, Krishna has declared in the Bhagavad Gita that the worship of these demigods are not very intelligent. Kamaistaiste ritjana prapadyante natevata tam tam niyamamastaya prakritanyata swaya. He has also declared that one has to give up all kinds of demigod worship and simply concentrate on Krishna consciousness. Could be interpreted variously, right? The verse. Krishna's invoking the anger of Indra and later on chastising him is a clear indication to his devotees that those who are engaged in Krishna consciousness have no need to worship any demigod, even if it is found that the demigod has become angry. Krishna gives his devotees all protection, and they should completely depend on his mercy. Indra cursed the action of the inhabitants of Vrindavan and said, "By defying the order of authority of the demigods, the inhabitants of Vrindavan will suffer in material existence. Having neglected the sacrifice to the demigods, they cannot cross over the impediments of the ocean of material existence." Indra further declared, "These cowherd men in Vrindavan have neglected my authority on the advice of this talkative boy who is known as Krishna. He is nothing but a child, and by believing this child, they have enraged me." Thus he ordered the Samvartaka cloud to go and destroy the prosperity of Vrindavan. "The men of Vrindavan," said Indra, "have become too puffed up over their material opulence and are overconfident due to the presence of their friend, Krishna." I'll read that again because I left one word out. Indra said, "They've become too puffed up over their material opulence and are overconfident due to the presence of their tiny friend, Krishna. He is simply talkative, childish, and unaware of the complete cosmic manifestation. Although he is thinking himself very advanced in knowledge, because they have taken Krishna so seriously, they must be punished. They should be destroyed with their cows." In this way, Indra ordered the Samvartaka cloud to go to Vrindavan and inundate the place. It is indicated here that in the villages or outside the towns, the inhabitants must depend on the cows for their prosperity. When the cows are destroyed, the people are destitute of all kinds of opulences. When King Indra ordered the Samvartaka and companion clouds to go to Vrindavan, the clouds were afraid of doing this mischief. But King Indra assured them, "You go ahead, and I will also go, riding on my elephant, accompanied by great storms." and I shall apply all my strength to punishing the inhabitants of Vrindavan. Ordered by King Indra, all the dangerous clouds appeared above Vrindavan and began to pour water incessantly with all their strength and power. There was constant lightning and thunder, blowing of severe wind, and incessant falling of rain. The rain seemed to fall like piercing sharp arrows. By pouring water as thick as pillars without cessation, the clouds gradually filled all the lands in Vrindavan with water, and there was no visible distinction between higher and lower land. The situation was very dangerous, especially for the animals. The rainfall was accompanied by great winds, and every living creature in Vrindavan began to tremble from the severe cold. Unable to find any other source of deliverance, they all approached Govinda to take shelter as lotus feet. The cows especially, being very much aggrieved from the heavy rain, bowed down their heads, and taking their calves underneath their bodies, they approached the Supreme Personality of Godhead to take shelter of his lotus feet. At that time, all the inhabitants of Vrindavan began to pray to Lord Krishna. "Dear Krishna," they prayed, "you are all-powerful, and you are very affectionate to your devotees. Now please protect us, who have been much harassed by angry Indra." Upon hearing their prayer, Krishna could understand that Indra, being bereft of his sacrificial honor, was pouring down rain that was accompanied by heavy pieces of ice and strong winds, although all this was out of season. Krishna understood that this was a deliberate exhibition of anger by Indra. He therefore concluded, "This demigod who thinks himself supreme has shown his great power, but I shall answer him according to my position, and I shall teach him that he is not autonomous in managing universal affairs. I am the supreme lord over all, and I shall thus take away his false prestige, which has arisen from his power. The demigods are my devotees, and therefore it is not possible for them to forget my supremacy. But somehow or other, he has become puffed up with material power and is thus now maddened. I shall act in such a way as to relieve him of this false prestige. I shall give protection to my pure devotees in Vrindavan, who are at present completely dependent on my mercy and whom I have taken completely under my protection. I must save them by my mystic power." Thinking in this way, Lord Krishna immediately picked up Govardhan Hill with one hand, exactly as a child picks up a mushroom from the ground. Thus he exhibited his transcendental pastime of lifting Govardhan Hill. Lord Krishna then addressed his devotees, "My dear brothers, my dear father, my dear inhabitants of Vrindavan, you can now safely enter under this umbrella of Govardhan Hill, which I have just lifted. Do not be afraid of the hill and think that it will fall from my hand. You have been too much afflicted from the heavy rain and strong wind. Therefore, I have lifted this hill, which will protect you exactly like a huge umbrella. I think this is a proper arrangement to relieve you of your immediate distress. Be happy along with your animals underneath this great umbrella." Being assured by Lord Krishna, all the inhabitants of Vrindavan entered beneath the great hill along with their property and animals, and they all appeared to be safe. The inhabitants of Vrindavan and their animals remained there for 1 week without being disturbed by hunger, thirst, or any other discomforts. They were simply astonished to see how Krishna was holding up the mountain with the little finger of his left hand. Seeing the extraordinary mystic power of Krishna, Indra, the king of heaven, was thunderstruck and baffled in his determination. He immediately called for all the clouds and asked them to desist. When the sky became completely cleared of all clouds and there was sunrise again, the strong wind stopped. At that time, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, known now as the lifter of Govardhan Hill, said, "My dear cowherd men, now you can leave and take your wives, children, cows, and valuables, because everything is ended. The inundation has gone down, along with the swelling waters of the river." All the men loaded their valuables on carts and slowly left with their cows and other paraphernalia. After they had cleared out everything, Lord Krishna very slowly replaced Govardhan Hill in exactly the same position it had been before. When everything was done, all the inhabitants of Vrindavan approached Krishna with feelings of love and embraced him with great ecstasy. The gopis, being naturally very affectionate to Krishna, began to offer him yogurt mixed with their tears, and they poured incessant blessings upon him. Mother Yashoda, Mother Rohini, Nanda, and Balaram, who is the strongest of the strong, embraced Krishna one after another, and from spontaneous feelings of affection, blessed him over and over again. In the heavens, different demigods from different planetary systems, such as Siddhalok, Gandharvalok, and Charnalok, also began to show their complete satisfaction. They poured showers of flowers on the surface of the earth and sounded different conch shells. There was beating of drums and being inspired by godly feelings. Residents of Gandharvaloka began to play on their tamburas to please the Lord. After this incident, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, surrounded by his dear friends and the animals, returned to his home. As usual, the gopis began to chant the glorious pastimes of Lord Krishna with great feeling, for they were chanting from the heart. Thus ends the Bhaktivinoda purport of the 25th chapter of Krishna, Devastating Rainfall in Vrindavan. And we have third canto part 4. Kapila. Used to be in 4 parts. This chapter is called The Glories of Devotional Service. It's chapter number 25. Chapter 25, third canto, 25th verse, The Glories of Devotional Service. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sri Shaunaka said, although he is unborn, the Supreme Personality of Godhead took his birth as Kapila Muni by his internal potency. He descended to disseminate transcendental knowledge for the benefit of the whole human race. Shaunaka continued, there is no one who knows more than the Lord himself. No one is more worshipable or more a mature yogi than he. He is therefore the master of the Vedas, and to hear about him always is the actual pleasure of the senses. Therefore, please precisely describe all the activities of the pastimes of the Personality of Godhead, who is full of self-desire and who assumes all these activities by his internal potency. Sri Suta Goswami said, the most powerful sage Maitreya was a friend of Vyasadeva. Being encouraged and pleased by Vidura's inquiry about transcendental knowledge, Maitreya spoke as follows. Maitreya said, when Kardama left for the forest, Lord Kapila stayed on the strand of the Bindu Sarovara to please his mother, Devahuti. When Kapila, who could show her the ultimate goal of the absolute truth, was sitting leisurely before her, Devahuti remembered the words of Brahma had spoken to her, and she therefore began to question Kapila as follows. Devahuti said, I am very sick of the disturbance caused by my material senses. For because of this sense disturbance, my lord, I have fallen into the abyss of ignorance. Your lordship is my only means of getting out of this darkest region of ignorance, because you are my transcendental eye, which by your mercy only I have attained after many, many births. You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the origin and supreme Lord of all living entities. You have arisen to disseminate the rays of the sun in order to dissipate the darkness of the ignorance of the universe. Now be pleased, my Lord, to dispel my great delusion. Due to my feeling of false ego, I have been engaged by your Maya and have identified myself with the body and consequent bodily relations. Devahuti continued, I have taken shelter of your lotus feet because you are the only person of whom to take shelter. You are the axe which can cut the tree of material existence. I therefore offer my obeisances unto you, who are the greatest of all transcendentalists, and I inquire from you as to the relationship between man and woman and between spirit and matter. Maitreya said, after hearing of his mother's uncontaminated desire for transcendental realization, the Lord thanked her within himself for her questions, and thus, his face smiling, he explained the path of the transcendentalists who are interested in self-realization. The Personality of God had answered, the yoga system which relates to the Lord and the individual soul, which is meant for the ultimate benefit of the living entity, and which causes detachment from all happiness and distress in the material world, is the highest yoga system. O most pious mother, I shall now explain unto you the ancient yoga system, which I explained formerly to the great sages. It is serviceable and practical in every way. The stage in which the consciousness of the living entity is attracted by the three modes of material nature is called conditional life. But when the same consciousness is attached to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one is situated in the consciousness of liberation. Situated in the consciousness of what? When one is completely cleansed of the impurities of lust and greed produced from the false identification of the body as I and bodily possessions as mine, one's mind becomes purified. In that pure state, he transcends the stage of so-called material happiness and distress. At that time, the soul can see himself to be transcendental to material existence and always self-effulgent, never fragmented, although very minute in size. In that position of self-realization, by practice of knowledge and renunciation in devotional service, one sees everything in the right perspective. He becomes indifferent to material existence, and the material influence acts less powerfully upon him. Perfection in self-realization cannot be attained by any kind of yogi unless he engages in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for that is the only auspicious path. Every learned man knows very well that attachment for the material is the greatest entanglement of the spirit soul. But that same attachment, when applied to the self-realized devotees, opens the door to liberation. The symptoms of a sadhu are that he is tolerant, merciful, and friendly to all living entities. He has no enemies. He is peaceful. He abides by the scriptures, and all his characteristics are sublime. Such a sadhu engages in staunch devotional service to the Lord without deviation. For the sake of the Lord, he renounces all other connections, such as family relationships and friendly acquaintances within the world. Engaged constantly in chanting and hearing about me, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the sadhus do not suffer from material miseries because they are always filled with thoughts of my pastimes and activities. O my mother, O virtuous lady, these are the qualities of great devotees who are free from all attachment. You must seek attachment to such holy men, for this counteracts the pernicious effects of material attachment. Satam prasangam mama virya sambido bhavanti hritkarna rasayana kata taj joshadat ashu apavarga vartmani shadaratir bhaktir anukramishriti. In the association of pure devotees, discussion of the pastimes and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is very pleasing and satisfying to the ear and heart. By cultivating such knowledge, one gradually becomes advanced on the path of liberation, and thereafter he is freed and his attraction becomes fixed. Then real devotion and devotional service begin. Thus consciously engage in devotional service in the association of devotees. A person gains distaste for sense gratification, both in this world and in the next, by constantly thinking about the activities of the Lord. This process of Krishna consciousness is the easiest process of mystic power. When one is actually situated on that path of devotional service, he is able to control the mind. When is he able to control the mind? He's thus consciously engaged in devotional service in the association of devotees. A person gains distaste for sense gratification, both in this world and in the next, by constantly thinking about the activities of the Lord. This process of Krishna consciousness is the easiest process of mystic power. When one is actually situated on that path of devotional service, he is able to control the mind. Thus, by not engaging in the service of the modes of material nature, but by developing Krishna consciousness, knowledge and renunciation, and by practicing yoga, in which the mind is always fixed in devotional service under the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one achieves my association in this very life, for I am the Supreme Personality, the Absolute Truth. On hearing this statement of the Lord, Devahuti inquired, "What kind of devotional service is worth developing and practicing to help me easily and immediately attain the service of your lotus feet?" The mystic yoga system, as you have explained, aims at the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is meant for completely ending material existence. Please let me know the nature of that yoga system. How many ways are there by which one can understand in truth that sublime yoga? My dear son Kapila, after all, I am a woman. It is very difficult for me to understand the absolute truth because my intelligence is not very great. But if you will kindly explain it to me, even though I'm not very intelligent, I can understand it and thereby feel transcendental happiness. Sri Maitreya said, after hearing the statement of his mother, Kapila could understand her purpose, and he became compassionate toward her because of being born of her body. He described the Sankhya system of philosophy, which is a combination of devotional service and mystic realization, as received by disciplic succession. Lord Kapila said, the senses are symbolic representations of the demigods, and their natural inclination is to work under the direction of the Vedic injunctions. As the senses are representative of the demigods, so the mind is the representative of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The mind's natural duty is to serve. When that service spirit is engaged in devotional service to the Personality of Godhead without any motive, that is far better even than salvation. Bhakti, devotional service, dissolves the subtle body of the living entity without separate effort, just as the fire in the stomach digests all that we eat. I got to read that again because Bhakti Patrick just walked in. You got to hear this. Hare Krishna. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is Lord Kapiladev speaking to his mother, Devahuti, Lord Kapiladev's incarnation of God. So he gives this verse, Jarat yashu yad kosham, ya kosham, nirginam analoyata. Bhakti, devotional service, dissolves the subtle body of the living entity without separate effort, just as fire in the stomach digests all that we eat. Purport. Bhakti is in a far higher position than mukti because a person's endeavor to get liberation from the material encagement is automatically served in devotional service. The example is given here that the fire in the stomach can digest whatever we eat. If the digestive power is sufficient, then whatever we can eat will be digested by the fire in the stomach. Similarly, a devotee does not have to try separately to attain liberation. That very service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the process of his liberation, because to engage oneself in the service of the Lord is to liberate oneself from material entanglement. Sri Bilvamangal Thakur explained this position very nicely. He said, if I have unflinching devotion unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, then mukti, or liberation, serves me as my maidservant. Mukti, the maidservant, is always ready to do whatever I ask. For a devotee, liberation is no problem at all. Liberation takes place without separate endeavor. Bhakti, therefore, is far better than mukti, or the impersonalist position. The impersonalist undergoes severe penances and austerities to attain mukti, but the bhakta, simply by engaging himself in the bhakti process, especially in chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, immediately develops control over the tongue by engaging it in chanting and accepting the remnants of foodstuff offered to the Personality of Godhead. As soon as the tongue is controlled, naturally all other senses are controlled automatically. Sense control is the perfection of the yogic principle, and one's liberation begins immediately as soon as he engages himself in the service of the Lord. It is confirmed by Kapiladev that bhakti, or devotional service, is gariyasi, more glorious than siddhi, liberation. Translation. A pure devotee who is attached to the activities of devotional service and always engages in the service of my lotus feet never desires to become one with me. Such a devotee who is unflinchingly engaged always glorifies my pastimes and activities. O my mother, my devotees always see the smiling face of my form with eyes like the rising morning sun. They like to see my various transcendental forms, which are all benevolent, and they also talk favorably with me. Upon seeing the charming forms of the Lord, smiling and attractive, and hearing his very pleasing words, the pure devotee almost loses all other consciousness. His senses are free from all other engagements, and he becomes absorbed in devotional service. Thus, in spite of his unwillingness, he attains liberation without separate endeavor. Thus, because he is completely absorbed in thoughts of me, the devotee does not desire even the highest benediction obtainable in the upper planetary systems, including Satyaloka. He does not desire the 8 material perfections obtained from mystic yoga, nor does he desire to be elevated to the kingdom of God. Yet even without desiring them, the devotee enjoys, even in this life, all the offered benedictions. The Lord continued, "My dear mother, devotees who receive such transcendental opulences are never bereft of them. Neither weapons nor the change of time can destroy such opulences, because the devotees accept me as their friend, their relative, their son, preceptor, benefactor, and supreme deity. They cannot be deprived of their possessions at any time. Thus, the devotee who worships me, the all-powerful Lord of the universe, in unflinching devotional service, gives up all aspirations to become promoted to heavenly planets or to become happy in this world with wealth, children, cattle, home, or anything in relationship with the body. I take him to the other side of birth and death. The terrible fear of birth and death can never be forsaken by anyone who resorts to any shelter other than myself, for I am the Almighty Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the original source of all creation, and also the Supreme Soul of all souls. It is because of my supremacy that the wind blows, out of fear of me. The sun shines out of fear of me, and the Lord of the clouds, Indra, sends forth showers out of fear of me. Fire burns out of fear of me, and death goes about taking its toll out of fear of me. The yogis, equipped with transcendental knowledge and renunciation and engaged in devotional service for their eternal benefit, take shelter of my lotus feet. And since I am the Lord, they are thus eligible to enter into the kingdom of Godhead without fear. Therefore, persons whose minds are fixed on the Lord engage in the intensive practice of devotional service. That is the only means for attainment of the final perfection of life." That's the last verse. That chapter is from the third canto, 25th chapter, and it's entitled The Glories of Devotional Service. 325. It's the 25th chapter, third canto, 25th chapter. It has 44 verses. And I'm not going to read the fundamental principles of material nature. Understanding material nature, Kapila's instructions on devotional service. Adverse reactions, you want to hear that? Wow. Description of adverse fruit of activities by special request in the front row. Front row agitator. Description by Lord Kapila of adverse fruit of activities. Please fasten your safety belts. This personality of God, it said, as a mass of clouds does not know the powerful influence of the wind. A person engaged in material consciousness does not know the powerful strength of the time factor by which he is being carried. Whatever is produced by the materialist with great pain and labor for so-called happiness, the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the time factor destroys, and for this reason the conditioned soul laments. The misguided materialist does not know that his very body is impermanent and that attractions of home, land, and wealth which are in relationship to that body are also temporary. Out of ignorance only, he thinks that everything is permanent. The living entity in whatever species of life he appears finds a particular type of satisfaction in that species, and he is never averse to being situated in such a condition. The conditioned living entity is satisfied in his own particular species of life, which, while deluded by the covering influence of the illusory energy, he feels little inclined to cast off his body, even when in hell, for he takes delight in hellish enjoyment. Such satisfaction with one's standard of living is due to deep-rooted attraction for body, wife, home, children, animals, wealth, and friends. In such association, the conditioned soul thinks himself quite perfect. Although he is always burning with anxiety, such a fool always performs all kinds of mischievous activities with a hope which is never to be fulfilled in order to maintain his so-called family and society. He gives his heart and senses to a woman who falsely charms him with Maya. He enjoys solitary embraces and talking with her, and he is enchanted by the sweet words of the small children. The attached household remains in his family life, which is full of diplomacy and politics, always spreading miseries and controlled by acts of sense gratification. He acts just to counteract the reactions of all his miseries. As if he can successfully counteract such miseries, he thinks that he is happy. He secures money by committing violence here and there, and although he employs it in the service of his family, he himself eats only a little portion of the food thus purchased, and he goes to hell for those for whom he earned the money in such an irregular way. When he suffers reverses in his occupation, he tries again and again to improve himself. But when he is baffled in all attempts and is ruined, he accepts money from others because of excessive greed. Thus the unfortunate man, unsuccessful in maintaining his family members, is bereft of all beauty. He always thinks of his failure, grieving very deeply. Seeing him unable to support them, his wife and others do not treat him with the same respect as before. Even his miserly farmers do not accord the same treatment to their old and worn-out oxen. The foolish family man does not become averse to family life, although he is maintained by those whom he once maintained. Deformed by the influence of old age, he prepares himself to meet ultimate death. Thus, he remains at home just like a pet dog and eats whatever is so negligently given to him. Afflicted by many illnesses, such as dyspepsia and loss of appetite, he eats only very small morsels of food and he becomes an invalid who cannot work anymore. In that diseased condition, one's eyes bulge due to the pressure of air from within and his glands become congested with mucus. He has difficulty breathing, and upon exhaling and inhaling, he produces a sound like gura, gura, a rattling within the throat. In this way, he comes under the clutches of death and lies down, surrounded by lamenting friends and relatives. And although he wants to speak to them, he no longer can because he is under the control of time. Thus, the man who engaged with uncontrolled senses in maintaining a family dies in great grief, seeing his relatives crying. He dies most pathetically in great pain and without consciousness. At death, he sees the messengers of the Lord of death come before him, their eyes full of wrath, and in great fear, he passes stool and urine. As a criminal is arrested for punishment by the constables of the state, a person engaged in criminal sense gratification is similarly arrested by the Yamadutas, who bind him by the neck with strong rope and cover his subtle body so that he may undergo severe punishment. While carried by the constables of Yamaraj, he is overwhelmed and trembles in their hands. While passing on the road, he is bitten by dogs, and he can remember the sinful activities of his life. He is thus terribly distressed. Under the scorching sun, the criminal has to pass through roads of hot sand with forest fires on both sides. He is whipped on the back by the constables because of his inability to walk, and he is afflicted by hunger and thirst. But unfortunately, there is no drinking water, no shelter, and no place for rest on the road. While passing on that road to the abode of Yamaraj, he falls down in fatigue, and sometimes he becomes unconscious. But he is forced to rise again. In this way, he is very quickly brought to the presence of Yamaraj. Thus, he has to pass 99,000 yojanas within 2 or 3 moments, and then he is at once engaged in the torturous punishment which he is destined to suffer. He is placed in the midst of burning pieces of wood, and his limbs are set on fire. In some cases, he is made to eat his own flesh or have it eaten by others. His entrails are pulled out by the hounds and vultures of hell, even though he is still alive to see it, and he is subjected to torment by serpents, scorpions, gnats, and other creatures that bite him. Next, his limbs are lopped off and torn asunder by elephants. He is hurled down from hilltops, and he is also held captive, either in water or in a cave. Men and women whose lives were built upon indulgence and illicit sex are put into many kinds of miserable conditions in the hells known as Tamishra, Anda Tamishra, and Raurava. Lord Kapiladev continued, "My dear mother, it is sometimes said that we experience hell or heaven on this planet, for hellish punishments are sometimes visible on this planet also. After leaving this body, the man who maintains himself and his family members by sinful activities suffers a hellish life, and his relatives suffer also. He goes alone to the darkest regions of hell after quitting the present body, and the money he acquired by envying other living entities is the passage money with which he leaves this world. Thus, by the arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the maintainer of kinsmen is put into a hellish condition to suffer for his sinful activities like a man who has lost his wealth. Therefore, a person who is very eager to maintain his family and kinsmen simply by black methods certainly goes to the darkest region of hell, which is known as Andhatamisra. Having gone through all the miserable hellish conditions and having passed in a regular order through the lowest forms of animal life prior to human birth, and having been thus purged of his sins, he is reborn again as a human being on this earth. It's a good way to start class. Any comments?
It's a summarization, isn't it? I mean, the fifth counter gives a complete description of all the hellish
counts. Yeah, that's somewhat of a summary. There's some more, yes. There's a microphone.
When it says one's relations, what exactly does that mean?
Pardon?
When it says relations, like the individual will suffer and all of his relatives will suffer. What does it mean by relatives? Like, what does that mean for the Atma? Like, what does that mean for the soul? Like, what?
Well, karmic relations. We're all bound together by certain kinds of karma, and in this life, next life, we have relations, like it mentioned here, mother, father, sons, uncles, aunts, and all those particular jivas are put together in a place due to their past karma. They come together for some time, just like when you go to a restaurant and you sit down and you meet a bunch of people and you make friends. You go to a seminar for a couple of days, make friends, and then you get up and you go somewhere else. So we're all coming together like that due to our past karma. And then, you know, there may be implications also. Certain kinds of living entities, you know, if you borrow money from someone and don't give it back, you may have to, in the law of karma, you have to come back and pay him back in the next life, and he has to come back to collect from you. So karma is very complicated, but that, you know, and how we all come together at a particular time, particular place is kind of mysterious, but karmana daivanetrena jantor deho papatye striya pravishta udanam pumsaureta ganashraya, it's taking place under daiva, a higher, you know, authority. And the point here is everything's being accounted for. And in other sections, the witnesses are described. Who knows what I'm doing, what I'm thinking, what my activities are. So the sun and moon are witnessing, the directions are witnessing, the air. There are many different witnesses to all my activities.
Reminds me of that movie, It's a Wonderful Life.
In what way?
George Bailey.
I know the movie well, right. But I'm just how it's related.
So George Bailey wasn't around to influence everyone in the town, his family, in a positive fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of his relatives suffered as a result of him not being there. Or if he had been someone that was mired in materialism, then it's likely his relatives would also be mired in materialism,
mm-hmm,
as well.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to lead not only themselves but others out of the darkness, I guess is one way to say it.
Yeah, and we're all interdependent also. There's a way that we're all tied together. Yes. Another microphone.
So is it like when a spiritual master takes on the karmic reactions from his disciple, is it similar that by the karma that we have, we're put into the position that we have with the other individuals that we're related to, so that we kind of also share in with their karmic reactions? Is that...
Yeah. A spiritual master will act like an attorney. You know, in the case when you get really bogged down legally, you don't want to represent yourself. It's not a good idea. We've seen it, you know, when people try to represent themselves, even if they're a little bit acquainted with the law, they usually don't do a good job. So you have to get a good representative who knows how to get you off and has good connections. As a good lawyer knows the law and a great lawyer knows the judge. So you want to be connected. That's the idea. And a guru means somebody who's, guru means heavy, someone who's heavy because they're heavy with knowledge. They're heavy because they're connected. They're all interconnected. It comes through Parampara system. So when you become connected and you put yourself, you throw yourself on the mercy of the court with a good attorney, then all your relations become affected also. Dvishad, vipra dvishad, yatad, help me out here, Gauranga, there's a, tad aravindanama, par aravindamukat swapacham varishnam, anye, manye cha arpita mano vache neti harta pranam punati sakulam na budhimanaha. Prahlad Maharaj says that a person who doesn't matter their qualification externally, even if they're not a Brahmin or something like that, if they've taken shelter, Hare Krishna, of the process of devotional service, then that person not only delivers himself, he can be delivered, but his whole family can be delivered also. And there are generations that are delivered. Because it's a personal process also. When you please Krishna, then he goes a great length to make sure that he takes care of you and your whole family for generations, actually. And so Prahlad Maharaj, what kind of family was he born into? Huh? Demoniac family, Ugrajate. So he's known, he's born into a family of demons. But because he pleased the Lord, and actually there are many others that tried to please Lord Nrisingadev. Manye dana bijana rupa tapasu chao jas teja prabhava bhala purusha bhuri yoga. Narada nai hi bhavanti parasipungso bhaktyatu tusha bhagavan gajayutapaya. And that he describes how it doesn't matter what your external qualifications are. You may have wealth, you may have strength, you may have beauty, all these things, but the only thing that pleases the Lord actually is bhakti. And by pleasing the Lord with your bhakti, then as Prahlad Maharaj, he was, became very dear to the Lord, even though the demigods offered streams of excellent prayers in perfect Sanskrit, Brahmadaya, Suragana, Muneyota Siddha, Satvai Katana, Katayo Vachasam Pravahe, Naradi Tum, Puraganar, Napi Pipru, Kim Toshnamarati Samehar, Ugrajate. They offered streams of excellent prayers to Lord Nrisingadev, but still he wasn't satisfied. But then Prahlad Maharaj, with a little bit of bhakti, pleased the Lord, even though he was just a child. So he said, anyone can please the Lord through this method of sincerely offering prayers. And then, of course, Prahlad Maharaj's family, his whole dynasty became glorified because of that. Later on, there were other personalities in his family, like Bali Maharaj, who appeared later. And Bali Maharaj was benedicted by the Lord. You know how he was benedicted, right? Because Upendra, the dwarf incarnation of the Lord, came and begged from him 3 paces of land. And Bali said, take more than that, because I can, you know, I can certainly give a lot more than that. I'm the emperor. And he said, no, just 3 paces is all I need. If I needed more than that, then I wouldn't be satisfied with whatever you gave me. But he took the 3 paces of land, but of course with the first one he covered the whole earth, and then he covered all the rest of the universes and kicked a hole in the covering of the universe so that the Viraja River came through, coming down as the Ganga from the spiritual world. And then where was he going to place his 3rd foot, because he already took everything? So Bali Maharaj offered his head. And then, of course, the Lord tied him up with the ropes of Vasuki and humiliated him. But he benedicted him also. He became the doorman for Bali Maharaj. And Bali Maharaj became famous for surrendering to the Lord like that. But why was it that he was so much favored by the Lord that he gave him all those benedictions? Ultimately, it was because he was related to Prahlad Maharaj. And then later on, Banasura was also in the dynasty of Prahlad Maharaj. And when he was a great demon, he had 10,000 arms. And the Lord fought with him. And he cut off all his arms except for a couple. And he spared him also. And he was also, because he was in the family of Prahlad Maharaj, he was favored by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So even if you're somehow connected to the family or dynasty of a pure devotee, then you're favored by Krishna. Adi, you were going to say? Oh. Yes. Microphone. Is it? Sorry about that.
Could you say something about the description of the hellish planets? It seems a little... the suffering could be taken as disproportionate to, or, you know, it seems excessive, more than what would be the law of karma, for example.
Well, do you have something on your mind you want to say about it?
Well, there's a couple interesting statements in this chapter, but I don't... It's still a question for me. Like, I guess one of them, it says he travels like hundreds of thousands of miles in a few seconds. Kind of talking about how he has to walk down that path. So it's like 100,000 yojanas or something in a few moments. And the other kind of interesting statement, it says sometimes we see hellish conditions even in this world. So this statement seemed to indicate that it's not something 100% literal, but what is it?
Well, suffering in this world by the living entity, can you hear me now? It seems a little loud to me. Oh, did you just turn it up? Okay. I moved it in and we turned it up. So, well, Maitreya and Vidura have this discussion about the suffering of the living entity in the material world. And Maitreya says that when we dream, sometimes we have hellish dreams. He gives us an example. So you might have a dream where you're getting your head cut off, but how can you witness your head being cut off literally? But in a dream, you can experience it. So someone might say, well, that's not actual suffering because you're actually only dreaming. So is it suffering or isn't suffering? It is, actually. You're suffering because at that time, you're identifying with that illusory condition and you actually suffer. So, bhayam dvitiya abhinibheshita syad. Abhinibheshita means the absorption in something that's not Krishna, and that's really the source of all our suffering. And these kinds of torment that come along are actually a kind of mercy, as it mentions here. There's purification that takes place when ultimately we develop in our heart this feeling that I don't want to stay in the material world anymore. This is a great moment of truth for the living entity to come to that position and become completely determined not to stay here anymore, to become completely detached, or to have a feeling that this is not my home. So the hellish conditions are there for, you know, we can hear about them, and we can also experience them just by looking around and seeing in this, you know, we're sort of in the middle planetary systems where there's some not much anymore, but sort of heavenly conditions. And there's also very hellish conditions. And through intelligence, we can understand how much of a suffering condition it is to stay in the material world. And we can also understand that there's reactions to these kind of activities that take us far away from Krishna. And that's, you know, it helps us to become more determined. As far as whether, you know, how literal they are, you know, the descriptions of hell and you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur and his essay on the Bhagavat is willing to concede to people who can't accept those that, you know, it's not absolutely important to take it literally. But I think either way, you know, if you hear it sincerely and openly, you can understand and relate more to the fact that there's unlimited suffering available in the material world. Like I said to you the other day, it can't get any worse. I forget what we were talking about. And you said, oh no, it can always get worse. Did you want to say anything more about that? Yes, Adi Guru Prabhu. Give him a mic.
I have a question. Actually, I will just for my clarification, just continue on his question. So I heard one analogy that when a guru accepts a disciple, then the guru acts like a brahmana. So the person who is getting initiated, so guru acts as a via medium to connecting that person to Krishna. So ultimately that person's relationship is with Krishna, and that person's relationship is not directly with the guru. But because the Guru Maharaj is initiating that person, so therefore that person tries to worship Guru Maharaj or Guru as good as Krishna, but still he maintains a difference that Krishna is a separate person. So my question was, is this like sometimes this analogy can give rise to like in our Vaishnava culture, we worship Guru. Prabhupada we worship every day. And also, you know, Narottam Das Thakur Bhajans also it is mentioned that we need to worship Krishna, we worship Guru. So, is this analogy correct or?
Satyadeva will answer that. Hare Krishna.
Analogy is when a person gets married, so the brahmana who is doing a marriage, so bride and groom, they're getting married. So the analogy is that the same thing is with initiation. So a brahmana who is doing the sacrifice for the bridegroom, the person who is getting initiated doesn't get married to the brahmana. You know, she gets married to a groom. And similar way, the initiation is that a new devotee is accepted as a disciple by the spiritual master, but that new devotee is not getting... So here the analogy is, the groom is like Krishna, and the bride is like the to-be-initiated disciple. And the guru is like a brahmana. So the bride doesn't get married to the guru. She gets married to the groom. And similar way, like when a guru initiates a disciple, the disciple gets actually connected to Krishna, not to him. And therefore, the disciple... So the question some people ask is that why do we worship guru? And Prabhupada somewhere writes in one purport I read that because that's a Vaishnava quality in Prahlad Maharaj's prayers to Narasimhadev, that when Prahlad Maharaj says that I want to worship Narad Muni because so when Narasimhadev asks him to ask for a boon, then he says that I want to serve Narad Muni. But this analogy is a little bit I have problems with. Can you...
Maybe, let me see if I can rephrase the question. I think what you're asking is when a person gets initiated, they're reestablishing their relationship with Krishna, and they're reestablishing their relationship through the guru. So what is the relationship between the disciple and the guru and the disciple and Krishna? How does the guru and Krishna relate to the disciple? What is their relationship? And Prabhupada gives different examples. One example he gives is that The guru is like the post office box, or sometimes he says the post office peon, which means that the guru himself, he doesn't really have any authority. But just like, the postal worker, as a worker himself, may not be anything special, but he's representing the authority of the U.S. government. Right? So if you went up to a mailman, right, and you tried to steal mail, or if you try and steal mail from a mailbox, it's a federal offense. You know, it's a felony. It's a serious crime. When I used to work, as a medic, if someone attacked me, it was automatically a felony because I was representing the government. Now, if I wasn't at work and I took off my uniform, I would have just been when somebody attacked me or committed battery or something, it might just be a misdemeanor. But if a person's representing the government, then they have the authority of the government behind them. So they're not the government, but they're related to the government when they're serving in that position. So that's one example, is that the guru is representing Krishna, and the disciple can surrender to Krishna by surrendering to a guru who is in disciplic succession. Because anyone can say, yes, I'm surrendered to the Lord. But the Lord isn't personally present. But when you surrender to a guru, you're surrendering to somebody who's living, who's, who you have to deal with. And also the guru has to take on, because the guru is vowing to, he's representing, like the attorney, he's representing the disciple to Krishna. He's saying, I vouch for this person. This person's now surrendering unto you, and they've agreed to follow your instructions. And I'm willing to vouch for them. And if they don't, then I'm also responsible. I have to take on some of their karma. And Prabhupada says that sometimes the guru has to suffer the reactions of his disciple, and sometimes in dreams, and sometimes in illness, and sometimes in anxiety. So the guru and Krishna and the disciple all enter a relationship based on commitment and surrender. And the guru has authority because he has a guru, because he's in disciplic succession. And in that one verse that Vaisheshika Prabhu quotes, he says, Bhayam dvitiya vinivesha tashad ishara pitasya viparya yo shriti tanmaya yato buddha abhijetam patyaika yesham gurudeva tatmam. This verse is from the Bhagavatam, 11th canto, and Lord Chaitanya quotes it, I think, to Sanatana Goswami or Rupa Goswami?
Sanatana.
He says that the living entity comes to this world and he ignores Krishna, then he begins to suffer, and he suffers many fears. And as Vaisheshika Prabhu was pointing out, this suffering has a purpose. It causes us to wake up and realize that this isn't our home, and then it's great mercy, because then we get an inkling that to let go of this material world and start to go back to Godhead. So in that verse it says that one can reestablish this relationship after turning away from the Lord and falling into the state of suffering and fear. One can reestablish the relationship by worshiping the Lord in three ways. One is by seeing the Lord coming to him as the guru and worshiping the guru. And then one should also see the Lord in the form of the deity, and then one should see the Lord in the form of his very life. So in these three ways, while he continues his life in the material world, he stays connected to the Lord and reestablishes his relationship even while in this material body, by honoring the Lord in these three ways: as the guru who saves him, as the deity who is there to receive his worship, and as his very life force. Does that answer your question? Yeah? You sure?
Okay.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for coming. Hare Krishna. Anything else? Hare Krishna. So we're continuing on the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Yes.
Just about, you know, when these descriptions of the hellish planets, and is it real or is it imaginary, or how do we understand the time difference? And just because of the medical advancement, you know, there's so many people who normally would have died 25 years ago even, that tend to live now. And so they have what they called near-death experiences. And one of the very common experiences is for, in a split second, for the person's whole life to flash before them in great detail. Like every time they, you know, cause somebody else pain. Or many, many of the details of one's life, one can experience it in a, relatively in a matter of seconds. So in this, in that respect, it would be possible, you know, to, considering that time is relative, to, you know, go to the hellish planets and experience great suffering, and that seemed like lifetimes and lifetimes, but it may just be a few seconds like an earth time, and then for purification. And then the other thing is on this planet there is so much suffering going on. I mean, what if you were born in Darfur right now? You know, just incredible. Or in the middle of Iraq, or even in this, you know, downtown San Jose or downtown San Francisco, there's, you know, human beings are doing some really torturous, outrageous things to each other. And they just, you know, happen. You run into the wrong person at the wrong time, and suddenly everything, you know, is rosy, and then the next minute, you know, this crazy person walks into your house, tortures all the family members, and gradually kills them off, and, you know, all the kids and everything. And practically, except, you know, unless you understand the science of transmigration and karma, these things are mind-boggling. And even other religions can't really explain them. And so, but they are, nonetheless, they are going on. They may seem inconceivable, or maybe we cannot clearly explain them, but nonetheless, it's a reality, and it is going on. And there is an explanation. There is a cause for everything. As far as, in my experience, Bhagavad Gita and the knowledge of the Vedas gives way more detailed explanation of why bad things happen to so-called good people than I found anywhere else.
What else?